I'm Christopher Lighton. Speaking of legends, Duke Ellington's stature keeps on growing. With Louis Armstrong and Charlie Parker at the peak of the jazz pantheon, Duke Ellington presides as really nobody else does. In his full 50-year career, he was jazz's most prolific and best composer. Bandleader, in his case, meant more than being Duke of the dance floors. He was rather a ringleader of genius in an orchestra that played like an extended but intimate family. Ever stylish, his styles came and went. Duke Ellington was an icon all his professional life. He bestrode the jazz century at his head, much as Shakespeare led the parade of Elizabethan poets in the English Renaissance. So who was the man, Duke Ellington, behind that elegant mask, asks the jazz trombonist and psychobiographer A.H. Lawrence. The comprehensive story, Duke Ellington and His World, is next, as the conversation continues. Audio streaming is provided by New England Streaming Media. Underwriting comes from ENA, Eric Nelson Architects, providing creative solutions for living and working, on the web at ena-ma.com. And from Gail Leander Public Relations, helping authors publicize their progressive books. Contact glpr at aol.com. And from Suzanne and Bob Petrucci. I'm Christopher Lydon, recalling Duke Ellington. At his funeral in 1974, Ellington's friend Stanley Dance eulogized him as a jack of all musical trades and master of all he had turned his hand to. The complex human being, he said, was at once sophisticated, primitive, humorous, tolerant, positive, ironic, childlike, lion-like, shepherd-like, Christian. A natural aristocrat with a common touch, the greatest innovator in his field who built on old foundations in disdained fashion. Into a new century, the famous Ellington tunes are classics. The tonal palette still sounds fresh and brilliant. The man himself still fascinates. We're talking this hour about the new biography of Duke Ellington by A.H. Lawrence, once a jazz musician whom Duke knew as Junior, the French horn player. Larry Lawrence is also a psychiatric social worker who doesn't hesitate to call this a psychobiography of a prodigiously libidinous, political, hugely ambitious, jealous, and religious man. Our phone is 617-450-2923. Join the conversation with A.H., known as Larry Lawrence, about Duke Ellington and his world. With rocking and rhythm in the background. Larry, you bring an unusual set of tools to this job. Give us the Larry Lawrence angle on Duke Ellington.
Well, I tried to put him in the context of his times, and through the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, and he managed to adapt himself as time went along, so he was never static. In other words, if he were born 10 years earlier or 10 years later, we probably would have never heard of him. So that when he got to the Cotton Club in 1920, the radio was just coming in, phonographs were coming in, and those instruments he used to move himself along. So that by 1930, he had been in the movies, he had his records were bestsellers, and he was heard from coast to coast, border to border.
Let's just deal with the psychobiographical elements for whatever importance they may or may not have. He was the only son of a very delightful and educated mother who adored him. It was the great relationship of his life. Mm-hmm. He married young, left his wife in Washington, moved his mother and his father to New York, and had an arrangement there with his son and his father in one bedroom, his mother and his sister in another, and himself and his mistress in yet another.
In the master bedroom.
What do we make of this menage and this man in the middle of it?
Well, as I note in the book, he was in the master bedroom. And he basically got his father out of his mother's bed and rule the house. He would come home and say, open up the door and say, Mother, I'm home to dine. And she would cook and do what mothers did for handsome, elegant sons. And she basically worshipped him, and he worshipped her. When she came to New York in 1930, the first thing he did was buy her a 16-cylinder Pierce Arrow automobile, and then hired a chauffeur to drive her around. My cousin recalls seeing that Pierce Arrow going down 7th Avenue, and when they get to a red light, people run up to the car, because they all knew it, and ask her how Duke was doing and where was he, and she would sort of sit in the back like she was the Queen of England and give that Queen Elizabeth wave as it went down 7th Avenue.
And she used to tell him, you are blessed, Edward. You can do no wrong, in effect.
And Freud said, a man who has that kind of backing from his mother will never know failure. And he never knew failure, never experienced failure as he saw it.
No rivals either, I mean, at home, like Sinatra, an only son, mm-hmm. like John Updike, a lot of very...
Picasso.
Blessed, productive people.
Yeah, he was an extraordinarily productive man, could sit and write music anywhere, in a railroad car, or back of a bus. And the important thing about that was he could concentrate, focus his mind and sit there in the middle of chaos and write a piece of music. It was an extraordinary gift.
All his life he had that sort of the mask of the handsome band leader who said, and we do love you madly. Get behind that mask. You're talking about a man who was composing every minute.
Well, I think it was Freddie Washington said to me, everybody who knew him thought they knew him. She said, but if you were his lover, you saw one side of him. If you were a musician, you saw another side of him. And if you were his family, you saw another side of him. But nobody ever saw the complete Ellington. I don't think he really existed as a complete person, if you know what I mean.
Well, we should listen for it in the music, although it's tremendously varied. I also love to read fragments of Duke Ellington. He had an amanuensis in Stanley Dance, who did a lot of his formal writing. Mm-hmm. But the stuff he wrote very early on that sounds like the real man. Later on, his memorial to Billy Strayhorn sounds like something he himself wrote. I want to take that into the race question, because it strikes me he was a race man in the very best sense. He had a racial agenda. He was the leading spirit of the Harlem Renaissance in a certain way. And he wrote in 1931, I mean, he was, 32 years old himself, mm-hmm. about his ambition. He said he was working on music, and I'm putting all I have learned into it in the hopes that I shall have achieved something really worthwhile in the literature of music, and that an authentic record of my race, written by a member of it, shall be placed on record. That's a big charter.
That's quite a mandate, and I think he lived it out through all of his life, because he starts out in 1930 with Creole Rhapsody, which is his first extended piece. Then Reminiscing in Tempo in 35 is a memorial to his mother. Then we go to Black, Brown, and Beige. And the problem with Black, Brown, and Beige was the critics, when they heard it, didn't quite understand what he was doing, and then proceeded to tear it apart. And as Ruth Ellington pointed out, that he never went back there again. He'd been there once, and he got burned, and went out and started to do the sweets.
What burned him?
He felt the critics just didn't understand what he was trying to do. And they basically uniformly panned him.
Well, there was always a question with the critics about his long-form ideas. He didn't abandon those, but was it also part of the racial statement that the critics tripped on?
Well, I think the critics never saw beyond the fact that he was a black jazz musician. That's all they saw. And how dare he now try to mount the podium of Ellington or Mozart? When in fact, he was closer to Haydn than anyone else, in that Haydn had the Esterhazy Orchestra at his beck and call every day, so he could hear his music when he went the next day after he wrote it. Well, Ellington had his orchestra at his beck and call. He wrote a piece of music, he could hear it the next day. No, but no other composer could do had that good fortune.
People said often, I mean, he was a pianist, but his real instrument was the orchestra. It was a, as you say, it was his laboratory, it was his plaything, it was his band of brothers.
Well, the important thing about the orchestra was that he had everybody's instrumental sound in his head. Harry Carney tells the story of they're on the railroad train going somewhere out to California, and Cootie Williams picked up Juan Tizol's valve trombone and played one or two notes on it, and Ellington burst out of his stateroom and said, "What was that? Not who, what was that? That sound."
It seems to me that the really interesting thing about the in a psychobiography here is this whole question of how he managed that band. There were geniuses, reprobates, junkies, drinkers, all kinds of men in that band over the years, a lot of them very difficult, and he mastered them.
And
how did he do it?
He was the master psychologist. He knew their strong points and their weak points, and he also could write for them. And they knew when he wrote for them, they knew nobody else could do that. And that was one of the reasons that they stuck around.
For example, it didn't always go just one way. He didn't just write for them. Barney Bigard thought that he had stolen Mood Indigo from his own warm-up exercises. There was a lot of that in the band, feeling that Johnny Hodges thought he had stolen ideas.
Yeah, the important thing is he would hear the idea, and all of a sudden it would show up a couple of weeks later, a couple of days later, hooked onto somebody else's idea. But he put it together. As somebody pointed out, he was like a movie director. When you watch a movie being shot, it's all over the place, and then the director puts it together to make a full-blown piece of a movie. And I think Ellington's music was that way. There were bits and pieces that he would take and put together to make an extended, a regular composition. The best example is they were on the road, and when they were on the road, they used to end up by playing Art Hickman's tune, Rose Room. And as they were playing Rose Room, Bigard would solo, and it would start breaking down the set. And at one point, Bigard played a riff, and Lawrence Brown answered on the trombones. And then Hodges did something else, and Ellington didn't say anything, and all of a sudden he put it together, and it became In a Mellow Tone, based on Hodges' In a Mellow Tone. So that's the way he did it.
You describe a wonderful scene where he would get three or four players in a room just to work out voicings. He would play a chord, and he'd say, "No, I want to hear, baritone sax on the A-flat or whatever, and the clarinet and the trombone or the trumpet," and he would shift it around, and he was working out his color scheme.
Yeah, actually it was the full band. He'd bring them into the Cotton Club and pay them scale, just the voice chords.
Explain what voicing chords means.
He would take the baritone sax and say, "Harry, you take that note and give that note to Cootie. And Johnny, you take the note that Barney has and try that again." Then they would move it around again so that the notes moved around on the chords to get the sound that he wanted.
It's said that, and you say in the book that Fletcher Henderson's band had a higher standard of musicianship. You had to be able to read better or play faster. Duke's standard was not virtuosity, it was individuality. He wanted a strength of a voice. Paul Gonzalez later on, Ben Webster earlier on. What does that tell you? What does that tell a psychobiographer?
He was much more interested in the sound and the overwhelming element of sound and the various instrumentalists that he had hired. Henderson's arrangements were written out to a T with little spots for soloists, and Henderson and Redman were hell of a good arrangers. But Ellington was a tonal colorist. as opposed to Henderson, who was basically a brilliant orchestrator. But Ellington was tone colorist, if that makes any sense. Hmm.
There was a lot of friction in that band. Johnny Hodges, it was said, always used to sort of make a little sort of motion with his hand when he would come up to solo because he didn't think Duke was paying him enough or Duke had stolen songs or whatnot. There were other rebels from time to time. Why did they stay with Duke?
Because it was the best job in the world. They couldn't go anywhere else. And
that's another interesting question. Why did none of them succeed, really, including Johnny Hodges, when they tried to go out on their own?
Because the band was the sum of its parts. Each one of those individuals contributed to the orchestra, but each one of those individuals, when they went out on their own, couldn't make it. Because it was Ellington and them that put it together, if that makes any sense.
What would a management guru say about Duke as leader?
He'd throw up his hands and walk away. He couldn't, it was Ellington's sheer magnetism and personality. It also kept them together. They knew they had the best job in the world, and they also knew they couldn't make it on their own.
You know, in your book, you quote his son Mercer saying that Duke Ellington's idea of real pleasure, or just relaxation, or just something to do with his time, was to sit at home at the piano and play blues.
Yeah.
I want to just listen to a little bit of him playing Beale Street Blues. This was with Johnny Hodges in the early 60s.
Yeah.
But it's a nice little intimate visit with Duke at the piano. That was Johnny Hodges, but here's Duke solo at the piano. We're talking about the late, great Duke Ellington with his biographer, A.H., known as Larry Lawrence. The book is called Duke Ellington and His World. We're listening to the blues pianist there with J. Johnny Hodges and Sweets Edison. Who taught Duke Ellington?
Basically, he taught himself. And I want to comment on that recording, the extraordinary intimacy between all the players, as though they'd been doing that all their lives, when in fact Edison just came in to play the gig. But you had this extraordinary sense of intimacy, like they'd known each other all their lives, musically, and been playing together all together, like the Budapest String Quartet, who've been playing together for years, when in fact two of the people there was their first gig with Ellington.
Joe Jones was playing drums.
Three.
That was unusual.
Yeah. And you have the guitar, Spanza on guitar, and you have Harry Edison on trumpet.
Yeah. There he is. But of course, Hodges and Ellington were...
Yeah, intimates. Musical intimates.
In the band, Hodges was known as Little Duke. Michael James told me that.
Yeah, Little Duke, yeah.
The assistant.
And also, Hodges himself was an extraordinary instrumentalist. And part of his problem, he was so good, and he could improvise endlessly and flawlessly. Most of the time, when you heard him in a jam session, and he was playing, the ideas just flowed. You know, just a marvelous sense of an arching line. It was great to hear him.
Talk about Duke as a pianist. Not the ultimate pianism, but a completely distinctive sound. He came out of, he credited Willie the Lion Smith and James P. Johnson above all, but he sounded entirely like himself.
Well, Louis Russell, who was a pretty good pianist himself, said that if you listen to Ellington, you could hear Willie Lyon in his right hand and James P. in his left. When I listened to him, that's what I listen for now, because he had a great left hand, which people don't realize. And that right hand was clearly Willie Lyon, which developed Ellington's own musical persona, evolved out of those two.
Hmm. Let's listen to from another cut of that same session. I think it was 1962, with Hodges and Edison. This is Weary Blues, and there's a substantial Duke introduction here. Let's just listen.
There used to be a statement by musicians in Harlem that Duke Ellington could take the blues and do more with them than any man alive. And this is a great example of it.
Mm.
Nobody could play the blues the way he did.
That's Harry Edison and Johnny Hodges with Duke Ellington at the piano. It is three men breathing together.
And as I said, you know, it sounds like they've been playing this like this all their lives.
And, yeah.
Here they are in a studio session, creating extraordinary sense of intimacy.
I want to get to another sequence, another trio. I think that, I misstated that. I think that was actually like 1958 or 59.
58, 59.
Something entirely different. A few years later, just 3 or 4 years later, when Duke recorded with Max Roach and Charlie Mingus,
yeah.
A famous album known as Money Jungle, completely different atmosphere in which sort of Granddaddy Duke had to kind of hold his own with the next generation, the articulately bebop guys, and he does.
And he also is holding his own with two incredibly great musicians, Max Roach, extraordinary percussionist, and Mingus, himself, extraordinary bass player. And he holds his own, too.
There's a famous story about that, and maybe you ought to tell it, about how Mingus rebelled on site and walked out of the studio.
He couldn't.
And Duke got him back somehow.
They were making a recording session, and Mingus walked out because he couldn't stand Max Roach. And Ellington was basically the person who kept the whole thing together. And he walked to the elevator, and Ellington said, "Mingus, my man, you know, you are fouling up this recording session. If Columbia Records had promoted me the way these people are promoting us, I'd still be with them." Mingus turned around and walked back into the studio.
Let's just listen with that introduction to Duke Ellington in a very combative relationship here with two younger giants of the new music, holding his own on his tune, Juan Tizol's tune for the Ellington band called Caravan. We need a scorecard when you listen to this Ellington Mingus Roach trio.
No, I think that it speaks for itself. These are three incredibly good musicians, again pulling together, and again like they've been playing together all their lives. And that, I think, is the genius of Ellington, to pull them together and act as though they've been playing together.
It feels so different from Duke playing blues with Hodges and Edison, but it still feels like Duke.
Yeah. It's Ellington. Well, the piano is Ellington. You just know that just from the articulation, the way he hits the keys. I think it was Günther Schuller said that. When Ellington hit a chord on the piano, you knew it was Ellington. Nobody else got that sound out of the piano, not even Art Tatum in Ellington.
Well, he's reclaiming the title here. Mm-hmm. He had questions about the new music, but he could play on their field. Let's take a break. We're talking about Duke Ellington and his world, the new biography by our guest, A.H. Lawrence. Audio streaming is provided by New England Streaming Media. Underwriting. Audio streaming is provided by New England Streaming Media. Underwriting comes from Pagito Systems Group, specializing in Java and Linux-based multi-tier application development, www.pagito.com, and from Align Incorporated, a Boston area Java engineering and consulting firm, and from Elsa Dorfman, Boston's Matthew Brady. Details available at elsa.photo.net. This is Duke Ellington in the early 1960s from the Great Paris Concert. The tune was Tutti Frutti, and I love it just for that exuberant fullness of the big band sound. We're talking about the late, great Duke Ellington and his world in a new biography, a psychobiography by our guest, A.H. Lawrence. You can join the conversation at 617-450-2923. Playing with Mingus reminded me of that line about the hedgehog and the fox among the great band leaders. The difference between the hedgehog and the fox being the hedgehog knows one thing in infinite depth. That was Count Basie, mm-hmm. and it was rhythm. And the fox mm-hmm. knows many, many things. Duke could do so much.
Well, the important thing about that was that his breadth and knowledge of music was across the board. And looking at the way he played the blues, for instance, he did more with that musical form than any man alive. And after he did that, nobody else wanted to play with him.
You are a student, especially a master of it all, I suppose, but a student especially of the early Ellington. I'd like to hear one of his original masterpieces, Black and Tan Fantasy. But I also want you to talk, in that context, the 20s into the late 30s, about his relationship, a very peculiar relationship with his manager, Irving Mills.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's in the book I note that Mills thought he, quote, discovered him in November of 1926. In fact, Mills had heard him before, but what we're listening to right now, the 1927 version of the Black and Tan Fantasy. This is one of the first songs Mills heard and asked him to record it. And it's an old spiritual that Bubba Miley and Ellington put together along with Otto Hardwick. And it's still one of my favorite recordings. I think this is the first or second Ellington recording I ever heard in my life. And I still marvel at it. Now, Mills, Ellington, I think, picked Mills. It's not the other way around. Mills
really?
Came in, and Ellington realized, 1926, he was a 27-year-old musician in New York. He had no access to recording studios. He had no access to getting his music published. Mills owned his publishing house. Mills guaranteed him work. And what Greer used to say was that Mills would come in the Kentucky Club and say, "We're recording tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock in such and such a studio. Have four things ready." And that was the way it was. So Ellington never had to, quote, look for work. Mills did that for him. He didn't have to worry about publishing his music. Mills did that for him. Now, Mills also got rich off of that. But Mills was the interface vis-a-vis the white musical establishment and literally led the charge for him. And you can't fault Mills for that.
It's one thing to get rich off him. The thing that sticks in any craw, I would think, is the fact that he got Duke to sign over co-authorship of...
No, he didn't sign it over. He simply put his name on it.
Well, but you know, when you... Mood Indigo, according to the, you know, the ASCAP credit, is co-written by Duke Ellington and Irving Mills. So is Sophisticated Lady. So is Caravan.
Yeah.
There's something outrageous about that.
Well, he was basically double dipping because he was his publishing house was getting music from the sale of the sheet music, then he was getting royalties from the music, and also booking the band. He's triple dipping, I should say.
It came to a very fast end in 1939 when Duke decided he didn't. There are all sorts of legends about this. He got a look at the books. Or he had other opportunities, or he was out of the Cotton Club thing. What happened?
Marissa said that he took a good look at the books and realized that Mills was charging him for stuff he shouldn't be charging him for and writing off, let's see, we call creative accounting. So that also by 1939, Ellington felt that relationship had gone as far as it could possibly go. And basically he said it's over, and they shook hands, and that was it. Now, the interesting thing is that Ellington got control of his music back, and Mills got the portion of the Cab Calloway band that Ellington owned. So the trade-off was mutually advantageous to both of them.
There was advantage for Duke Ellington in the Irving Mills thing. I mean, it may be. Some people feel that it was Irving Mills and his press agentry and his imagination that framed Duke as more than a band leader, something other than a Harlem dance band guy.
Absolutely.
Maybe even persuaded Duke that he was bigger than the others.
I think Ellington says in his biography, when he wrote, people wondered what he was going to say about Mills. And he says, basically, he preserved the dignity of my name, and you can't do it any more than that for another human being. Despite the fact that Mills got rich off him, but Ellington got famous as a result of Mills. Ellington's sheer musicianship we'll grant, but he needed somebody out front in 1929 and 1930 to carry the flag for him.
You say from the beginning to the end that Duke was the master of that relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, He made it plain to Mills what he wanted, and Mills says, "I'll get it for you." So that when he said they were going to California for the first time in 1930, Ellington said, "I'm not going to go. I'm not going to travel in a bus. I'm not going to go out to California in a bus." And Mills says, "Yeah, I'll get you a private railroad car." And that's how they traveled. But it wasn't Mills' idea to get the train. Ellington said, "Look, I'm not traveling by bus."
And he didn't like to fly. Speaking of trains, we're listening in the background to a happy-go-lucky local, a 1960s performance, but all through Duke's career, including A-Train, Daylight Express, he loved train songs, sounds of trains. Let's listen a moment.
Thank you.
He loved the trains. And you have to remember that from 1930 to 1941, that's the only way they traveled, by private Pullman railroad car. And
it finessed the question of public accommodations
exactly,
in the South, too.
Exactly. Ellington used to say, when people come up and see the railroad car, I say, my God, Duke, wow, isn't that wonderful? He said, well, that's the way the president travels.
There are a lot of other relationships of a personal nature in this man's life. We just talked a little bit about Irving Mills. Closest of all, it may have been Billy Strayhorn. Can you take that apart from the moment they met in Pittsburgh in, I guess, 38?
Mm-hmm. In the Stanley Theater. I think that what happened, Strayhorn was introduced to him, and Strayhorn, like Ellington, came and wanted to be a songwriter. And Strayhorn had brought some songs, including Lush Life, with him at that point. And Ellington said, well, play me something. And he started to play an Ellington tune. And Ellington said to his valet, get Harry Carney and get Johnny. He wanted Carney and Hodges to hear him play. And they sort of laying on of hands. And he said to Strayhorn, I'll send for you when I get to New York. Strayhorn couldn't wait, and went up to Newark, New Jersey, and tracked him down, and moved in with him and became basically a member of his family. The important thing was that he, as Mercer said, cracked the code. He deciphered the Ellington sound and was able to imitate it in his own style, if you know what I mean. So that...
Both said that they never knew where one man's mind picked up and the other left off. It was also a deeply intimate relationship. Some say a sexual relationship. Strayhorn was gay, alcoholic, depressive, and Duke adored him.
That was the son he never had, in a way. The daughter he never had, in essence. I think that what happened with he and Strayhorn, they were musical intimates. They knew each other's mind. If the copyist took the piece of music that the two of them had written, so you couldn't tell from the handwriting who wrote it, you wouldn't know where Strayhorn ended and Ellington began, or Ellington began and Strayhorn left off. It just, they were so musically intimate with each other.
We're listening to what may have been Strayhorn's last composition, called Blood Count, mm-hmm. written for, performed by Johnny Hodges. And it was recorded shortly after Strayhorn died by a band that was grieving, still weeping over the loss of Sweet Pea, as he was known, Billy Strayhorn. Let's listen to Johnny Hodges playing Blood Count by Billy Strayhorn. Johnny Hodges on Blood Count with the Ellington Orchestra.
I think you are absolutely right. They are grieving. They miss him. He's gone out of their lives forever.
They're angry about it.
And their lives will never be the same. Their musical lives will never be the same. And I think the real thing is that they miss him. And they miss him deeply.
Join the conversation at 617-450-2923. We're talking about Duke Ellington and His World, the new biography by A.H. Lawrence. Ken is on the line.
Hello, Chris. Hello, Larry.
Hi, Ken.
I remember reading Duke Ellington's autobiography a number of years ago called Music Is My Mistress, and found it odd back then that I don't think, if I remember correctly, I don't think anywhere in the book he mentions his wife or wives. To this day, I don't know if there were more than one.
Just one.
And also that I think, if I recall correctly, he only mentions Mercer out of the entire family. He only mentions Mercer once, and he mentions him in a musical context. Does that have... So we could examine the psychology of that as well. I mean, was music so dominant in his life that he thought the family wouldn't be interesting to readers?
Interesting question.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right that he was writing about, and also he was a rather narcissistic man. So he was writing about himself and his friends. It was sort of like he was sitting in a salon talking about the people he knew and what they were and what they did, let it be it that way. The memoir it's really a memoir rather than a biography, because it really isn't a true biography, or an autobiography actually, if you read it.
And the mask stayed on in that book. It's a very interesting book, Ken, but it's also sugar-coated. Everybody's a nice guy. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever did him wrong. I think, didn't Mercer say, that's the good memoir, and we'll save the rest for the bad memoir or something.
Yeah, and not only that, but Ellington, as I said, when he was writing it, Irving Mills was very, very concerned. What was he going to say about him? And Ellington basically said, he preserved the dignity of my name.
It's amazing how he did seem to, that persona that he had on stage and in his personal life sticks to a T in the book as well.
Mm-hmm.
The same Duke.
He was an entertainer.
Mm.
You eat it as entertainment.
So I guess if I wanted dirt, I was going to the wrong source. Huh?
Yep.
Well, it's not about dirt. There's also, and you get a lot of it into the book, Larry, there was a tremendous sadness in the end of his life. One of his best friends, Arthur Logan, his doctor, mm-hmm. was killed by muggers. Mm-hmm. He took the death of Strayhorn very hard, the death of Johnny Hodges very, very hard. He said, my band will never sound the same again.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mercer points out that he saw his father cry three times. He cried when his mother died, Ellington cried when his mother died, when Strayhorn died, when Logan died. That was the only time they ever saw him cry.
Wow. This is the tune credited to Mercer, but I'm sure Johnny Hodges wrote the idea, Things Ain't What They Used to Be, from the Great Paris Concert in the early 60s.
Well, the interesting thing about that, as I mentioned in the book, they were having a crap game, and Hodges ran out of money, so he sold it to Mercer for $25, and then proceeded to clean up the pot, so that so Mercer got...
But didn't get the tune back?
He sold it. He sold it outright. So Mercer owned it. Hodges sold it to him for $25.
But if he won the pot back, he might have said...
No, he won the pot of the crap game. He used the $25 just to put a stake in the crap game and won all the money, but never bought it back from Mercer.
I would have bought it back.
No, I think that Johnny could write him off like that. It didn't make any difference. I mean, he was like Fats Waller when in the 30s, when a guy would need some money, Fats would write out a tune, so take it downtown and sell it.
The painter Raphael was said to do the same thing. He'd pay the restaurant bill with a perfect circle.
Right.
Say, here's my debt.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly perfect analogy.
Who didn't like Duke Ellington?
You know, I don't know. When I was researching this book, the musicians were in awe of him. They didn't have a bad word to say about him. They would talk about the way he took people's tunes and made them into his own. And one of the things I note in the book, people said that he stole the tune for Concerto for Cootie from Cootie Williams, and Cootie Williams sold it to him for $25. And that was part of the trouble in the band, that they would sell Ellington the tune become famous, and the guy who wrote it would be upset about that.
The boppers were a rebellion in a certain way against Duke's style. They didn't dress like Duke. They didn't want to. They didn't like this royal name thing with counts and dukes and kings and stuff. Miles, in effect, was a kind of different, a very different personal statement. And some people felt Duke put him down. On the other hand, I don't find any trace of people disliking the man.
No, I had a hard time. It just didn't exist.
And what was the Miles relationship, you know?
Well, the Miles relationship I can define. If you go to Woodlawn Cemetery and you ask for Ellington's grave, you walk down a street, and the street bifurcates. On the left of that bifurcation is Ellington's grave. On the right of that bifurcation is Miles's tomb. He was buried right across the road from Ellington. I think that's a statement right there.
What was his relationship with Count Basie?
They were band buddies, brother. They were band brothers, so to speak. I mean, Basie wept unashamedly at his funeral. He missed him. They all held him in awe, and they were all buddies together in this incredibly interesting business of quote jazz unquote.
Coltrane recorded with him and surely loved him.
Mm-hmm.
He'd grown up, in effect, in the Johnny Hodges band in the 50s.
Yeah, and Coltrane said that Johnny Hodges was the greatest alto player alive that he ever worked with, and that's high praise.
But what about Duke?
Duke and what?
Well, what would Coltrane have felt about Duke?
Oh, I thought he felt that Ellington was just an extraordinary musician, that his way of sheets of sound has its basis in Ellington.
Let's listen a moment to the concert that brought Duke Ellington back in a big way in 1956, put him on the cover of Time magazine. This was his biggest selling album, the Newport album, and this is the blues sort of slow movement of the Newport Suite, Blues to Be There. There was a special relationship in the band with the baritone saxophone player Harry Carney, who drove Duke. The guys rode in a bus, but Duke rode in a big Buick
Chrysler.
Oldsmobile. Or was it a Chrysler?
Chrysler Imperial.
Yeah, with Harry Carney. They were intimates. How much did Harry ever record about his angle?
Well, he hired Harry when he was 17 because Johnny Hodges was in New York. That's who he wanted to hire when they were up in Salem in 1926. And Carney came up age 17, his first, went to work, worked with him that summer, then went back to New York and started his career as a musician. And Ellington brought him back to Salem the following summer.
That's the 20s. I'm thinking of the 60s and 70s when they were best friends on the road.
Well, it was a 40-year relationship. They knew each other. Ellington, Carney felt that, again, working for Ellington, he said he was ashamed to take the money. He had so much fun. He also realized that was his entire life. And when Ellington died, he told Sonny Greer, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know what I'm going to do. My life is over. And he was dead 6 months later.
Mm. That was true, well, of a number of them. The great Ellingtonians went fast.
Very quickly, yeah. It says something for his presence. And I want to go back to earlier in his life when they came to New York for the first time. And Ellington is in Washington. Greer and Wetzel and Hardwick are in New York, and the job that they had, that they thought they had fallen through. So they sent for Ellington this sort of vaguely written telegram telling him to come to New York. Ellington gets to New York, travels in style, smokes, leaves an excellent tip in the pool, in the club car, smokes a cigar, gets to New York, up to 29th Street, and he gets out of the taxi, Greer comes up and says, "Duke, we don't have any money, we're busted. What can you do?" And he said, "Don't worry, we'll find something." And sure enough, they got work. A couple of years later, they lost a job, and Duke said, don't worry, we'll get a job. That sense that everything, Greer said, we knew something was going to be right. It was going to be right, and it was going to work out, and it always did.
Although he didn't have a nickel in his pocket either.
No, that's right. And they got a gig. They got a gig. They're playing in the Oriental Club in Harlem, and Bricktop Smith heard them and got Baron Wilkins to hire them in his establishment on 8th Avenue.
At the end of the story, is this late recording from the memorial tribute to Billy Strayhorn. This was Duke at the piano, mm-hmm. almost an accident, yeah. after the session, playing Lotus Blossom, and he said...
Open mic.
Yeah, and he said Billy Strayhorn always liked him just to play Lotus Blossom. Mm-hmm. Beautiful tune from when? 30s?
That's a late Ellington composition, actually. Lotus Blossom.
Was it Ellington, not Strayhorn, that wrote it?
Strayhorn wrote Lotus Blossom.
That's what I thought. Yeah, okay.
He'd like to hear Ellington
Harry
play.
Carney joins in on the last chorus. Mm-hmm. There's no way to sort of end the conversation about Duke Ellington. It just goes on and on, but this is our cue to...
Well,
say thank you.
You're very welcome,
Larry Lyons, and thank you for just digging deeper and deeper into this incredibly interesting life. To me, it is the great American life of the 20th century.
Absolutely.
Endlessly interesting. Duke Ellington and His World is the name of Larry Lawrence's book. Thank you, Larry. Thanks also to Jonathan Krentel, Noel Flatt, Tim Harris, Morgan Anderson, and Jeremy Bowers. And to New England Streaming Media for audio streaming, and to the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at the Harvard Law School. The show is produced at the BNMP studio at the Christian Science Monitor by Tom Tiger, Hitesh Hatti, Catherine Bidwell, Jake Shapiro, and Amy McDonald. Mary McGrath is our senior producer. I'm Christopher Lydon.